I'm Stephen Caldwell, and you're listening to the Koshcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. We have got an absolute cracker of a Koshcast for you today. Bernie and Roche aren't here, but we've dipped into the transfer market and made a loan signing. And frankly, as much as we love the lads, and we do, we think it's a pretty big upgrade. Joining us today to talk about Toronto FC, this week's Premier League action, and answer your questions is former Premier League and MLS player and Toronto's favourite Scotsman, Stephen Caldwell. Let's get right into it. Hello and welcome to the Koshcast on underthekoshblog.com. My name is Alex. As always, I've got Mohamed next to me, and not as always, this week we are joined by Stephen Caldwell. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm really looking forward to this.
Absolutely. Mo, do you reckon Stephen will be better than Bernie and Roche?
He's already been.
Oh, that's unfair. I don't know what the other two guys are like.
Just takes them longer to get started, that's all. Anyway, we thought we'd start by talking about Toronto FC. The new season is only a couple months away now, or a month away even. The squad is really settled. The off-season has been, it seems like, deliberately calm and very low-key. But the only person coming in, Chris Mavinga, centre-back, left-back.
Yeah,
we're not quite sure where he's going to fit in. Do you expect any more transfer activity?
I do. I actually expect a little bit more transfer activity. It's obviously very difficult when you're looking for the calibre of player that Toronto FC will be looking for. You know, that number 10, that sort of creative guy in the middle of the park, I think's a little bit lacking in this squad. So I know that was a sort of aim of theirs. So I think they'll still be looking for that number 10 playmaker type guy. Again, not that easy to find. I don't know exactly how many dollars are left in the transfer budget to go and get that guy, because you know they'll be wanting a certain standard of quality to make sure that he can play or be a valuable member of the squad. So we'll see what happens there. But very interesting to see Mavinga. You know, obviously comes with good pedigree, and I think he'll probably play. I think Greg will go with three at the back to start with, and I think Mavinga might play that left side centre half role.
I mean, speaking of three in the back, they did play 3-5-2 as their main system last season. And clearly it's worked. I mean, they've got further than they've ever have, so close to winning the whole thing. I mean, they'll probably stick with that this season. But in kind of those three positions in the back, you've got the centre back, they're settled. But then you've got Bittershore out right wing back. Yeah. He's really the only option in that position.
Yeah.
Do you think they might need to strengthen there? I mean, what is really their options?
Yeah, well, I think Marky Delgado might be the sort of cover option there. I know he's a midfielder, youngish player who's did very well since he came to Toronto, and I think he has a lot of potential to develop as a player. And I think at this moment in time, he'll be the cover at right wing back. Stephen's been a great signing. Obviously, he's getting on a little bit in years, and you know, it would be crazy to think that he's going to play every single game this season. So they'll be looking for cover in that area as well. I think if they can get it, it'll be a sort of cheaper option in that right-back, right-wing-back position. And I think if they can't get it, they'll have Markey there to fill in that area.
That's interesting. He's got the pace to do it, and he might struggle for minutes central midfield with the other option. So, yeah, that makes some sense. Just sticking on the 3-5-2 at the moment, it's interesting that Toronto FC seem to be the only MLS club really going with this, at the same time that a lot of Premier League teams are going to three at the back, or some variant of it.
Yeah.
What do you think are the main advantages of that kind of system?
Well, it allows you to dominate possession. It allows you to get, obviously, everybody wants people in the middle of the park these days. It's a new kind of fashion to flood that area and have an overload in the middle of the park to dominate possession, to then hopefully score goals, obviously. It's definitely a trend right now. I think some teams do it very well. I think some teams not so well. I think the main thing for me with modern football is that we're really getting away from formations. I know we always like to stereotype or put a kind of a number on a formation, and I guess that's the kind of starting shape any game starts. Teams line up and they're in a formation, but it's absolutely irrelevant to me in modern football, because the best teams, and I'm talking about top level, and no disrespect to MLS, but I'm talking Premier League and Champions League football now, they're so fluid in their shape. They defend in a certain shape, they attack in a different shape, they usually have 2, 3, 4, sometimes 5, 6 players with Bayern Munich who can play in a number of positions, and they can just change like that during the game, which I think keeps people guessing. So for me, it's a really a dying thing to be playing in that certain 4-4-2 or 4-2-3-1 or 3-5-2. It's actually irrelevant, because you kind of attack in a certain shape, you have fluidity to your movement, and then you defend in a certain shape. And I was just at a game the other night. I was at Liverpool Chelsea. I was home for a few days, and I was there with TSN, and we watched that game. It was absolutely magnificent, and Liverpool were tremendous for 50 minutes. Now, they were playing against an unbelievable team, and they couldn't break them down. But what they did, they played their usual 4-3-3, whatever you call it, because right. the three forwards go wherever they want. What they did was, in possession, they usually the two centre halves will split really wide, and they'll play with high full backs, and they'll be somewhat open, maybe a Henderson or a Emre Can coming in that deepish position. What they did was they kept Milner back. They played like three in possession, and right. Milner played like left centre half. Emre Can moved out to the wing back sort of position, or sometimes Coutinho was in that sort of high wing back position. But what they wanted to do was to pin Victor Moses back and create five at the back for Chelsea rather than 3-4-3, right. you know. And it was really interesting to watch that live. We were sitting in great seats, and we could see the shape of the team. And even in the space of 15 minutes, it evolved to where Milner started to go a lot higher, like a conventional left wing back, left back, and Jordan Henderson or Emre Can came in that left centre half role. And it was, again, another indication of where football's going, the movement, the fluidity of the game.
Well, I mean, Klopp is definitely a great example of that fluidity of the game. He doesn't really stick to that one shape throughout the game, and Liverpool have done it really well this season, especially at the start of the season when it looked like, I think they were, to be fair, the best attacking side in the Premier League for a long time at that start. City were looking good as well at the beginning, but that is a great example where Klopp will not hold you to a position, especially when he played Firmino false nine before the whole Origi Sturridge involvement. So that is a very good example. The only other thing I want to touch upon on the 3-5-2 is that sometimes it sounds defensive, but I like the idea that it gives you two forwards up top. It's one of the rare formations that gives you two people up top, as opposed to the 4-3-3 or 4-2-3-1, which I think helps quite a bit with, I mean, in Chelsea's case, for example.
Yeah, well, especially like going back to Toronto FC, when you've got players like Jovinko and Altidore, and you need to get them into the team. Now, how do you do that without compromising the security of the rest of the side? And I guess that's where that came from.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, Alex. You know, the two guys have to play, they're designated players, they're in the team for a reason. Greg tried to go with that 4-4-2 diamond, and they were a little bit vulnerable in certain areas, and the 3-5-2 allows them to utilise his DP's best positions. You know, Michael Bradley's better in that deep position, getting on the ball, defensively magnificent in the playoffs, but sometimes needs that kind of player support in that area. So he was less vulnerable in the 3-5-2, and it meant the two guys could play up top with having to ask one of them to come out to the left hand side to kind of defend at times.
I mean, Altidore almost forced them as well, like with his form when he came back, he couldn't drop him, so you had to play him somehow as well with Jovinko. So
yeah,
that's true. Let's get to some listener questions. We got some people that are very excited that we were speaking to, as well as us, obviously. So the first one came in from Mario Rivas, and he said, what is the biggest difference between playing in the UK and MLS? And to add to that, Anas asks about the difference in personal life too.
Yeah, personal life, absolutely magnificent playing in North America. I was lucky somewhat. I knew a little bit about Toronto, but I feel I picked one of the best cities in the world.
Definitely.
Certainly in North America. I love it here. I loved it since the first minute I came. And my family are very settled. It's a magnificent place to bring up kids. Very safe. There's loads to do. Very cosmopolitan, as you guys know. It's just a magnificent place to live. Playing in MLS was a real eye-opener for me, actually. I sort of came here not really sure what to expect in terms of the football, and a little bit apprehensive, I guess, and thinking, you know, what's it going to be like? Am I going to enjoy it? And really, I was surprised for day one. It's fantastic. It's difficult. It's you deal with different kind of challenges than you would in English football. It's definitely a little bit slower. I think a lot to do with that is because it's a summer league. There's challenges with travel, you know. It has real differences from England and Championship, being 46 games, adding two cups, hopefully playoffs. you're in the 60s in games and you're just exhausted the whole time and the pitches are heavy and life is a slog. You can be mid-table to bottom half, it's just a grind, and then you can be top half and you're just flying along, you're winning every single game and life's brilliant. So I've been lucky enough to kind of experience both sides of that. And the pace of Premier League is so variable. You know, you kind of, you're in a game or you get promoted and you're playing at Anfield or Old Trafford, White Hart Lane, and you think, oh, this is great, we're in the game, and it just, they just change like that, and bang, they score a goal, and then you're in the game, and then you score another goal, and before you know it, you're 2-3-0 down. So really, the level and the changes in pace is extreme at that level, and we've not quite got to that quality in MLS yet. We're kind of, the good thing is we try to play football, most teams try to get the ball down and play through the lines and do the kind of what I think are the right concepts for exciting football, but just a little bit slow at times. Again, weather, travel, lack of quality, all play into that, I think.
All right, another question we got here is, so with the Canadian men's national team making a trip to Easter Road in March to play Scotland, in a friendly, obviously, Charlie Town was asking for your assessment on the state of these two national teams. I mean, both countries struggling slightly to kind of produce talent at this point.
Yeah, really difficult time. Scotland, first of all, is kind of strange, in my opinion. I do think they have a lot of talented players. And I love Gordon Strachan. I think he's a magnificent manager. I know he's having a really tough time just now, but I think we should stick with him. I don't see anybody else who's sort of better at the role just now. We are having a bad time. We're sort of have an influx of midfielders as normal, some good players, and we leave some good players out, but we kind of struggle at the two most important ends, I guess, the kind of central defensive position and the centre forward, the guy that's going to score the goals. A lot of hope that Oliver Burke's going to be that guy, kind of develop. I'm actually not too sure how much he's been playing in Germany. I don't think a great deal. I don't think he's starting every single game, which is disappointing and frustrating for him, I'm sure. But we need to try and develop that talent in the crucial areas of the park, and hopefully we can develop a gem, a real top centre half. Absolutely no disrespect to anybody who's there just now, but I think we're lacking that real quality in the two areas that matter. Canada, on the other hand, showed some promising signs, and I felt like they got really lost under Benito.
Yeah.
I think that they really needed a change there. Again, not a lot of talent, you know, need to find a kind of club type mentality to pick up some results. Do have some decent players, some quality players that I think can make them better. But I think just now they kind of have to focus on being hard to beat and having that togetherness and that club mentality to try and progress a little bit.
Yeah, all right. It was nice recently to see some young Canadians from TFC getting in the squad, but the team was still conceding goals, I think.
Yeah.
Was it Bermuda they went down to? And
yeah,
they won in the end, but it was dodgy for a bit. But, all right, a couple of more specific questions for you. Callum Gordon, what was the dressing room atmosphere like at Leeds in 2004? Did anyone down tools? He also says, thanks for scoring the winner against Blackburn, even though it was in vain, ultimately.
It was a really special time in my career to go to Leeds. It happened on deadline day, and I was playing for Newcastle at the time, and I was in the reserves. I was really out of the first team, which was frustrating and disappointing. And I'd signed the pre-contract with Sunderland, so I knew I was going to be playing for Sunderland in the summer. We tried really hard to make that happen in the January, and then financially it just wasn't going to happen. And I felt like I was going to be stuck in Newcastle for 5 months and, you know, playing reserves, and I was past that. I was 23 by that point, and I was lucky enough, I was on the bus going to a reserve game. I can't remember, we were playing, say, Sheffield or somewhere, and I got a call as we were pulling out of the city centre, and kind of jumped off the bus, spoke to a close friend of mine, Tommy Craig, who was the coach at the time, and I said, I'm off, Tommy, and I think I'm going to Leeds, and he was delighted for me. So I jumped off the bus, signed for Leeds, got there, and really the first time in my career I was playing regular first team football in the Premier League. So it was a magnificent time for me personally. It was tough for the club. We did have some guys who, I wouldn't say down tools, but I think any time there's that situation, they start to think about their future. And there was definitely some people that's minds were were looking elsewhere, which was a little bit frustrating because we had a lot of talent in that team. But honoured and privileged to have played for that club. Like, I can still remember some of the nights we played, the atmosphere of the games, and we actually did okay for the January to the May. And unfortunately, the hole that we were in, and near the end, we picked up some poor results. Won at Birmingham 6-9. I actually never had a great game myself that day, and we lost heavy, and that was kind of the beginning of the end, and it was bitterly disappointing to go down with that club.
Last one, I think. We've got Johnny Connolly asking, how's life with Keno as manager?
Oh.
I think that was like the
one
three
question
times.
I didn't want to answer. No, you know, when Roy came in, we were really in a difficult situation at Sunderland. We had got relegated the season before. I think it was the lowest number of points at the time. I think since been beaten by maybe Derby. So we were really struggling for confidence and quality. We had Niall Quinn come in with a new ownership group. There was excitement. Quinny couldn't find the manager he wanted, so he kind of took the job himself with Bobby Saxon and some other guys. We lacked leadership. We lacked kind of vision. Quinny would be the first to tell you he was never going to be a manager, a head coach.
Right.
But he was doing the job, waiting on the right guy. And Roy came in, and we got this reaction. And of course, it's Roy Keane. You look at him, you have respect for him, you know what he did as a player. He absolutely magnificent football player, one of my favourites when I was a young boy, young man. And he comes in and he gets that reaction. And I was the captain, I was injured at the time. I then got fit and I got back in the team. And then I got injured again with my thigh, is what normally happens. I had a bad knee and then I had a thigh, you know, so it was disappointing. And Roy and I had an okay relationship to start with, and then Roy took offence to me, kind of. And my contract was up in the summer, and I had a young baby or a baby on the way. My wife and I were going to have our first kid, and I was a little bit anxious about where my future was. So I was kind of having my agent ask what was out there, and Roy took offence to that, and he was mad, and he said there was no way I'd be leaving. And I thought, oh, fantastic, I'm here. And 2 days later, I'm in the supermarket and I'm shopping, and Roy calls me and he's like, you can leave if you want. And I'm like, what? You know, so it's funny, you know, my wife's like, oh, what did he want? I'm like, yeah, I'm leaving.
Put the stuff back. Yeah. Yeah.
That's Roy, just, you know, volatile and up and down, and certainly learned a lot of things from him. What to do and what not to do,
right,
is what normally happens with managers, and you make your own kind of opinions and you start to decide what way you want to go. But anyway, I ended up going to Burnley. I was resisting it for a while, and in the end I just thought he took the captaincy off me, which was disappointing from my point of view. He said some things that kind of were not true, and one thing I always was in my career was a great captain. I might have been the worst player or the slowest player, or you can say all these things, I'll accept that, but I was a fantastic captain, and he kind of took it off me and said something. So that was it. It was the beginning of the end, and I left for Burnley, and I'm delighted I did, because it was probably one of the best things I ever had in my career.
You played under Owen Coyle.
I did.
At Burnley, and we were wondering if, when Owen Coyle joined Houston as manager in 2014, I think, and you had already been there in 2013, we were just wondering, did he give you a cheeky call maybe?
No, we spoke a couple of times around about that time, and then obviously I congratulated him when he got the Houston job, but there was no call from Owen. I thought he might have called me to ask my opinion on a few things, but he never really called. We had sort of lost touch a little bit, and then we had kind of back in touch when he was my brother's manager at Wigan.
Right.
You know, he's a guy that I have a great deal of respect for. We had fantastic times at Burnley, and, you know, I was...
You got promoted together.
We did. We won the playoff final at Wembley, and when you go through an experience like that with people, you know, you always have that bond, no matter what. And, you know, if I seen him tomorrow, we'd be hugging and chatting and reminiscing, but we kind of grew apart, and there was never any option for me to go. And I actually never really looked anywhere else in MLS when I got to Toronto. I just felt this was my club. And
I mean, 2013, you were fans player of the year. So.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, I loved it for the second I got here, and the organisation have only, you know, been tremendous to me, gave me whatever I needed, made me feel very welcome even when I retired. So, It's my club, you know, I want to help it as long as they want me to stay.
All right, I know we want to move on to more topical things, but I have one last question.
Right.
It's just the up and down between the Premier League and the Championship.
Yeah.
Is it hard to always play at your top level, or do you kind of play to the competition, to the...
Yeah. Like you mean between the leagues?
Yeah, you know, you go up and down, and the question is, do you keep a level of consistency, or does it kind of drop and raise depending
on which? From a personal point of view, I think that I probably could have stayed at a Premier League team and been a bit part player, but I decided at 23 when I left Newcastle that I wanted to be a first team player.
Right.
I made that decision. And I probably could have stayed at Newcastle 10 years and played 10, 15 games a year. But I was never that guy. I wanted to be important. I wanted to be one of the main guys, one of the first names on the team sheet. And I left and I made that decision, and I'm so glad that I did, because I have memories and I have a career that I'm proud of for the talent that I had. And then when what happens is when you stop playing at a team for whatever reason, then you're like, well, I made this decision 2, 3, 5 years ago, I'm making it again. So I always used to knock on the manager's door and say, hey, I want to play, I'm telling you, if this doesn't change in 2 months, 1 month, then I'm off, you know. So I then moved to different teams, and I think I was a very good Championship centre-half, and I was a squad player for a Premier League team. I could have been a bit lucky and maybe played 2, 3, 4 seasons in the Premier League, but I don't think I was a top Premier League centre-half. So that was my niche market. I knew that, you know, I could get teams promoted. I was lucky enough to do that twice. And
I mean, you scored the winner for Sunderland against Leicester.
I did. My first season, I won the Championship, and I was playing with some fantastic players. Then a really bad season, then I was sort of part of 8, 9, 10 games of that next season at Sunderland, where they then won the Championship. So I still feel a little bit proud of that, even though I wasn't that important a player. But I was there for 6 months of that season, and I was the club captain, so I was
right.
I was an influence. And then I went to Burnley, and it was a rebuilding process. And really, that one season at Burnley, it's hard to pick one season over the other, but if I was pushed, I would say that was probably my favourite season in all of football, because I was playing for a team who were unfancied, who were going through somewhat financial problems, and we had a group of guys that were just amazing, like the best guys to ever be captain for. So many leaders, so many strong personalities, and you know, I was the leader of their leaders, you know. It was just like such an honour to be kind of that guy, and to play 62 games we played that season. We got to semi-finals of the League Cup, we lost to Tottenham Hotspur,
right.
We were 4-1 down in the first leg, we beat them 3-0 at Turf Moor. I was suspended, I wasn't playing, it's probably why we won 3-0. 3-0, and then we lose in extra time, and then we get to the last 16 of FA Cup, we lose at the Emirates, 3-0,
right.
They battered us because we beat them in the League Cup, and they were totally prepared for us, and you know, they were a magnificent team. And then we get to playoff final, and we lift the trophy at Wembley. So hard to pick a better season. A great decision I made to go to that club.
Played some good football while you did it. So
we did. We were
right,
exciting.
That team was a good team.
We had some good players. We had some guys in their peak. Wade Elliott was absolutely magnificent that season. Clark Carlisle and myself at the back. Brian Jensen had the season of his career. Some games you could not get the ball past this guy. He was just unstoppable. Eagles came in and he was fresh and young. Patterson, like, there's too many names. Robbie Blake was probably our player of the year. You know, he was getting on a little bit then, but he still had that guile and trickery. Graham Alexander, our kind of experience in the middle of the park, magnificent.
All right, I guess it's time to move on to some more topical stuff.
Yeah, we'll take a quick break and we'll be back with the Premier League. All right, let's start at Stamford Bridge, where Chelsea beat Arsenal 3-1 in a result that was totally unpredictable. I don't think anyone saw this coming. To start the game, Arsene Wenger actually made a slight tactical shift. I was baffled.
I mean, it wasn't the biggest shift.
No,
baby steps, I guess. You know.
Yeah. Ozil shifted wide for about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was all. But it didn't last long. But I mean, 3-1. I said it was unpredictable. Obviously, I was joking. Stephen, was there any other outcome for this game? I mean, did anyone in the pundit community think that Arsenal were going to do something here?
Well, I'm one of the biggest Arsenal fans, and I don't mean I'm a fan of the club, I just love the way they play. And I was back in the UK last week and I watched them play at Southampton against a sort of reserve slash youth team side, you know, and they were magnificent, like their movement, their play. And I always believe in it and I always get sucked in every single year. And I thought, you know, can they go? And I'd seen Chelsea on that same trip, so I knew how good they were and how organised they were. But I did think maybe they can go there and they can be the scintillating best. And then I was just so disappointed in the performance and the way that they kind of tackle the match. And I think it's key that you guys bring up Ozil. You know, when he's at his best, he's just magnificent. He's free flow and he can put things on a dime for people. He's just magnificent. And when he's not at his best, he just looks like he doesn't even want to be there. And I'm sorry, but to win a championship and to win a Premier League title, you need everybody. You certainly need your big players to be there every single game, mentally and physically and tactically prepared.
I mean, just so you know, you are preaching to the choir. Yeah, me and Alex are huge Arsenal fans. Yeah. So when we make fun of Arsenal, it comes from a good place.
a self-survival place.
But it's again, it's again what you said. You get sucked into the hope, and it's the hope that kills you. And I mean, I didn't think we were going to get anything out of this game, to be honest. And it's funny how that game at the Emirates, Chelsea-Arsenal, that's kind of what started Chelsea's climb to the point that they are. And then it's almost like this game secured the premiership for them. So it's like both Arsenal games were... Well, the first one was a turning point, and this one was kind of just a stamp on the premiership.
Glad to be of service.
Quick question about the Alonso Bellerin thing. I didn't think it was a foul, like when Alonso kind of elbowed him at the point. But then the more you kind of see replays, I start to shift my opinion a little bit.
I didn't think it was a foul. I thought that Alonso got up early. Yes, his elbow caught him in the face, and it was a really unfortunate fall, an incident for Bellerin, a guy that I love. I think he's absolutely fantastic. He's going to become one of the best, if not the best, right back in the world. But I didn't think it was a foul. I just thought, again, it epitomised the game. They just wanted it more. They were just tougher. He got up early, and no disrespect to Bellerin, he couldn't have did anything different. But he was there, he was up, he was hungry, and he scores a goal, and Bellerin comes down. So I don't think it was a big talking point. Again, Arsene Wenger's a tremendous manager. He changed English football. He certainly changed Arsenal Football Club. But it's time for him to go. He's at the end. He needs to step upstairs. He needs to step away.
Right.
He's not motivating the players the right way. They're not prepared for games. They're not mentally prepared for games.
Which he says, to be fair. I mean,
he said that. I couldn't believe it.
He says that a lot of times. He goes, I don't think our players were meant to prepare. And people are like, well, whose job is it?
Yeah.
No, but he does seem to be very laissez-faire. And like, he expects his players to do a lot of the kind of motivation and work themselves.
Yeah. Right.
Even though years suggest that it doesn't work.
But a lot of the ex-players have come out and said, people ask him, you know, how is he in the dressing room? Is he angry after a defeat? And they always say, no, he kind of lets us deal with it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, he has a lot of trust in his players. But with Wenger, I think... I believe Arsenal have a squad to win the Premier League.
Yeah.
Like, he's built a great team. I mean, some of the negative in the past was he doesn't spend the money and he hasn't built a team good enough. I think now he has his best squad since 2004. And he could win the... Like, I think another manager could win the league with his players. There's not a lot of holes in it anymore.
Yeah, I agree.
It really bugs me, actually, when people talk about the personnel. And they say, oh, we need another centre-back. He's not good enough. Or, oh, we need another... No, because the personnel has changed a lot in the last 10, 12 years. And the results are exactly the same. It doesn't make any difference. But just for the last point about Arsenal, and something that Wenger said recently was when he came out and talked about Kante. And he said he tried to sign him when he was in France,
mm-hmm.
and he tried to sign him again last summer.
Yeah.
Now, what does that say about Arsenal? If someone's at Leicester, and he ends up going to Chelsea, who finished 10th outside the Champions League mm-hmm. places, for me it says two things. One is Kante either took the money, which is obviously going to be a bit more at Chelsea than it is at Arsenal, although the difference might not be huge at this point. Or Kante looked at it and said, where am I going to actually win something?
Yeah.
And now, at what point do players stop going to... Like, top-level players stop going to Arsenal because they know that they're actually not going to win trophies?
The money... The problem with the money thing is that he costs 30 million. Xhaka costs 35. So, if wages is a problem, you take that 5 million and you give it to him.
Yeah.
Like, it clearly money isn't the issue. It's just, I think, a wrong choice.
I don't think it is the issue. I think he chose Chelsea because he's seen that as an opportunity to win titles. And he's probably going to be proven correct. I think there's big decisions coming at Arsenal. I think they might miss out in Champions League.
I think so too.
And if that happens, then, you know, we're talking about a guy like Kante going to Chelsea, choosing them over Arsenal. What's going to happen if they don't have Champions League football? Who's going to go there? You know, you don't have that carrot of Champions League football bad enough, and then you don't think you can win the title. Why would you go there? You know, so you're looking at that second tier, you know, European player. And again, not that they don't have extreme quality, but are they enough to win you the Premier League?
But Wenger's not the manager, I think, to take a slightly average player to the, like, he's not that, like, he will need a very strong squad if he's gonna.
He's not bringing in the best in his players, is he? And that for me is, you know, a serious indictment against his proposition to be manager next season. I think I hate saying it because I'm not one of the guys that jumps in his, but I think he's been magnificent for this English football, for the game, and I just think it's at that time he needs to move on. It's they need somebody fresh. Does he move upstairs? Is he still in charge of the finances? Possibly. I don't think that's too far away for reality. Do they go and get an Eddie Howe or somebody young and kind of fresh to coach him and try and bring out more in these guys? I think that's the way forward.
You talked about who might sign for them in the summer. Maybe Jamie Vardy might reconsider at this point. But speaking of Leicester, they lost 3-0 at home to Manchester United. They actually looked sound enough for about 35, 40 minutes. They kind of looked all right. And then it all fell apart really quickly.
They just can't seem to defend this season.
Yeah, well, I think it was Gary Lineker that said the other day, Huth and Morgan without Kante in front of them look like Huth and Morgan. Which I think is slightly harsh. Yeah. But
you get the point. Kante is definitely a big miss when it comes to the defensive side for Leicester. So.
Yeah, they're really struggling. They look anxious. They look like they're waiting on defeat, you know, which is a horrible position to be in. And I think we all knew or we all expected that they would struggle this season, but I didn't think they would get dragged into the relegation fight like they seem to be.
They're a few points above. I mean, it's worrying.
Yeah, it's really concerning because the other teams are starting to pick up results and you see like some improvement in the guys at the bottom. So, yeah, they're going to have to address it quickly.
Well, they are the only team in the top four, the top four English tiers of football to have failed to score a league goal in 2017. I mean, it's bad. And Ranieri keeps saying he doesn't know what's wrong, which is always a warning sign, I think, when the manager says that, because they're basically admitting defeat. I'm just wondering if you've ever experienced a situation like that where you're just in free fall.
Yeah, I have. When I first got to Burnley, I know it was a championship, but we were in free fall. I think we were in the middle of a 17-game winless streak. And under Steve Cotterill, who was the architect of Burnley's success, but he lost his job before it. Obviously, Owen came in and took us to that next level. But Steve was the architect. He had us very organised, and he bought me and he acquired a lot of the players that were part of the promotion team. We started seasons really well. We were like flying. We were really fit, and then we just kind of hit a slump and hit a wall. And when I got there, we were in the middle of this 17-game winless streak, and it was just horrible. We were losing and losing. And I remember we went to Southend. They were down near the bottom, maybe in the bottom three. They definitely were in the bottom three. And it was a gap between us, and we went there, and a draw would have been good, but, you know, we were kind of hoping to win. We get there, we're drawing 2 minutes to go. We lose a goal, we lose. And that night, I was awake the whole night. I was in a hotel at Gatwick Airport. And I was just like, oh, I'm going to get relegated. And we were just, you know, we were done. It was just horrible.
Some fans don't think it gets to the players. Like, they just don't
care.
Oh,
God, it was horrible. We were just, like Leicester, we just did not know what was going wrong, where we could win our next game. Thankfully, we did win our next game. I think we won two or three in a row near the end, and we finished 15th or something like that in the end. And we were, again, probably too good to go down from Championship. But the slide was alarming, and Leicester on that same kind of slide, you know, they're going to have to dig deep, pick up a big result or two. I think they will. I've got a feeling that they've got enough quality just to do that, to
they
pick up big
yeah.
wins, but until that happens, it's always a concern.
I mean, United are on the opposite side of the spectrum. They're on a really good unbeaten streak, so a few draws in there that kind of is halting the whole, like, the jokes about the sixth and all that, but they are on a good... I mean, Mourinho has finally found his best team. He's finally playing Mkhitaryan, who should have started every minute of every game impossible.
Yeah.
Because he's looking like one of their best players. And I think United are kind of... They're now pushing for the top four position where they might push out, you know, a Liverpool or an Arsenal. And do you think they have a good chance of kind of finishing in that top four?
I do. And I think it's because of Mourinho, and I think it's because they're tough, you know, and the looks of Arsenal and Liverpool in this 2017, they're really slumping, they look tired. They look like, again, they were the best attacking team. Now they look like they can't score a goal. Saturday was awful. And I think United are tough. I don't think they're a great team. I think I watched them against Wigan. I know it was against Wigan live. And they're just kind of static, and they rested a few players, but... They're not a great team, but they're tough. They have winners. They have guys that know how to get it done. And I think they've got a great chance of getting top four. And then they go into the summer, they maybe get a bit more quality in certain areas, and
like
they can challenge.
Yeah,
you get a Griezmann, and still think they probably need a centre-half and maybe a holding midfielder. Top guy. Carrick, I love. He's coming to the end of his career. You can't play every
Schneiderlin
minute.
Maybe something.
I mean, they just bought an 89 million midfielder. You think he would be enough, but
he's a straight player. You know, he's fantastic. He's going to be amazing. He's a straight player. He goes in the left. He goes in the right. He goes deep. He goes right up top. He goes where he wants. So you need somebody who's really smart with great discipline, who is there all the time, just to kind of. I like Viola at Borussia Dortmund, I think he would be fantastic. Somebody like that.
Toni Kroos.
Kroos is magnificent. Whether they can get him or not, I don't know. But somebody like that who can sit, hold that area, be solid in that midfield. If Pogba goes deep, has the intelligence and the kind of lack of ego to move into another position, like Carrick does. Carrick's been the best thing for Pogba. He should have started every game, but he's getting old, he can't start every game, so they need to try and find the new Michael Carrick for that club.
It's interesting you say that they're not a great team, because there are some teams, noticeably in the Premier League, you watch them play and the system is the star.
Yeah.
Like Chelsea, Spurs, but United, it is very much individuals, and so it kind of relies more on the form of those key players than it does on the collective, I think.
Well, absolutely. I think I can't remember who the ex-player that came out recently, and they asked him the difference between, I think it was Mourinho and Conte, and they said that you'd be surprised that Mourinho doesn't kind of drill the system into you.
Hazard.
As much as you think he would. It's like, it's almost like, we know what we're doing, we're footballers, he kind of lets us do our thing. You'd think Mourinho's there with a stick, and this is exactly what you do. And for him to say that Conte is more, is a bit of a scary thought.
Yeah.
Because Mourinho is that character that you think is definitely there with a chalkboard, and don't you dare come out of your circle that I've drawn, you know? So
it's funny when you think of the let's just say the three guys, Guardiola, Conte and Mourinho, you know, like you say, it looks like Mourinho's just like, don't you dare move out this square. But really, Conte's another level. He's just he is so specific for what he wants for his team. They actually play in little rhythms of set plays, you know, when Azpilicueta feels the pressure, Conte comes back to the ball. As he comes back to the ball, Moses starts to move back to the ball. It goes Azpilicueta into Kante, out to Moses. He just turns it in with his left foot. Doesn't even think.
He knows he's going to be there.
And Costa either goes in behind or comes in front, and it's a set play. And they do it like three or four times a game. It's like watching a good basketball team. It's actually drilled and worked on, and they're so specific with their roles and what they do. And again, I don't think they have Hazard and they have exciting guys, but I don't think they're that exciting a team, but they are so sure of their jobs, and that's what makes them great.
Speaking of the complete opposite, Liverpool, who are a very fluid system,
yeah.
but with that comes that defensive liability that they have, and that's been costing them all season. When they were scoring bucket loads of goals at the beginning, it didn't matter. People still kind of said, this is going to come and bite you in the ass, but it is now. It's catching up. They have won one game all of 2017, and that was Plymouth.
Yeah,
Jesus.
So, scary, 1-10.
Yeah, so it's not good enough, for sure. And then the latest result now, losing to Hull 2-0.
Uh-huh.
It's not like they were bombarding Hull's goal either. It was like they kept them in front of them, and they couldn't break them down. And someone was talking on a show recently, like a pundit, he was saying, Liverpool are almost found out. Just play deep.
Yeah.
They can't break you. Hit him on the counter, and you might get something.
Yeah, they're vulnerable. I think that they really lack quality in goalkeeper and in centre half. I don't love Matip. He's a solid player, he's fine, but really when you're playing that open, you have to be perfect, and he looks a little bit jittery to me. Can he improve? I don't know, maybe. But I think they need that leader centre half, difficult to get, but a sort of Piqué type character who's perfect in possession, you know, and Matip does a lot of like slack things on the ball. The goalkeeper doesn't fill the defence with a lot of confidence, obviously. Right. We've talked about the two guys all season. They need to find that guy, that top keeper that's going to give them confidence at the back. And I think they're looking a little bit tired. I think they look a little bit jaded.
Right.
Coutinho's struggled since he came back for his injuries. He's really been poor in the last two games.
Mane was at the Africa Cup of Nations.
Mane's been away. He's probably going to have a little bit of a slump for travelling that distance and being part of that. Sturridge has not been utilised. There's a real feud there, it seems, between Klopp and Sturridge. He's probably going to leave in the summer. And Origi, for me, is still too inconsistent. I love Firmino, I love Lallana. I think they've had fantastic seasons, but there's a lot of responsibility on their shoulders, and it's a little bit of worrying time. They're on the right track, they must stick with this guy. I really think they will, I hope they do, but he's fantastic. He's the right man for this club. Stick with him, give him as many pounds as you can in the summer to let him go and get what he wants, because they're on to something great, but they just need a bit more quality.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think even for the rest of the season, I think we'll see them pick up at some point. The question is, how soon will it be? Yeah. Will it be soon enough to get the top four spot? But I think, you know, they were in the title challenge for the first half of the season. I think they were ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
Just like when Brendan Rodgers took them close, no one expected it that season. And so I'm not surprised that they're tailing off a bit.
Well, their results against the top six have been great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, Bournemouth and Hull and Burnley. I mean,
but let's talk about Hull for a second, though, because Marco Silva's come in. It's been incredible.
Amazing.
I mean, Phelan seemed like he was doing an excellent job at the beginning of the season. It completely went off the rails.
Well, he only had like 13 players as well.
That is true.
Like that they enjoyed that adversity.
Exactly.
You know?
But it was like the film 300 or something. But then Silva's come in, and what struck me initially was the transfer window. For someone coming into a new club, to get rid of... He got rid of Livermore and Snodgrass. I think the Snodgrass thing was pretty much enforced because he didn't have a long on his contract. They had to get some money for
him. Once he left, everyone was like, well, that's them done.
Right.
Yeah.
But then they brought in Grosicki, I know nothing about. Nias, we knew from Everton. Ndai, Ranocchia is a coup.
Yeah.
And then Markovic, Evandro, Henriksen. It's a really high turnover, and making that amount of changes work in such a short space of time is incredible.
He's won all of his four home games.
Yeah.
He's battled really hard against United in the cup.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's doing great, and people obviously wrote him off because he's not, you know, your relegation manager that's famous for keeping people up, obviously. So I think he's doing a good job.
It's the snobbery English football where, you know, they don't know a lot about a European coach. So everybody starts saying, oh, who's this guy? You know, instead of, if it's me, and I never knew a lot about Marco Silva either before he came, but I don't shout my opinion. I wait, I read, I learn, I give the guy a chance, you know? And I'm lucky, my brother's good friends with Sean Maloney. He said day one, the guy comes in, he tells them what they're doing wrong. He has a plan. This is what we're going to, like, bang, just day one, first chat, this is what's happening. And the guys are like sitting back, wow.
Yeah.
This guy knows what he wants. Start. Now, can he convince the guys it's the right thing to do? He seems to be doing that. It's early days, but fantastic coach. Good signings. Ranocchia was amazing on Saturday.
Yeah.
Maguire, the lad that was at Sheffield United, actually played against them about 5 years ago when he was probably 12 or 18 at the time. He looks like he's really developing as a player, and this new style under Marco Silva is going to suit him because I think he lacks a little bit of pace, but they're a little bit deeper. And Grosicki's a magnificent player. We covered him in the Euros. We've seen him play. I've not seen a lot of him, but I really like the games that I've seen, the 6-7 games I've watched him play. So I think he can maybe replace Snodgrass a little bit with that kind of wide talent. And yeah, they're looking like they're going to be in the fight now. Now, I'm not saying they're going to stay up, but I think that they've got a good chance when we had them doomed.
Yeah, oh, for sure. I mean, we picked them at the very beginning of the season to definitely go down.
Yeah.
Moving on, we've got City, who seem to have been saved from above. Yeah. By the signing of Gabriel Jesus. He scored both goals against Swansea. I mean, he's a very young player. He's, of course, you don't listen to the podcast every week, but I don't like Aguero.
What are you saying?
I just an assumption, a hunch. I don't like Aguero very much. He's a very good player. His stats are magnificent. You know, people will tell you his stat pads against the weaker teams doesn't show up a lot in the big games. I feel that his overall play contribution to City in a game is not enough. That if they're playing bad, everybody's playing bad. He can't kind of like... I just feel they lack a bit with Aguero up top for someone that can kind of be more involved in the overall play. And Jesus is slowly maybe showing that. He's giving them that a little bit.
Sergio Aguero will leave Manchester City this summer. 100%, in my opinion.
Just clip this. Note down the time. On
the- yeah, yeah.
And there's a reason for it, because Pep is very specific about what he wants from players, and he's not getting it from Aguero. Now, he's a world-class striker. He'll go and sign for a world-class team, and he'll probably score loads of goals.
Right.
And I think he would still score loads of goals for City. But Pep is so specific about what he wants from his team and from players that if he's not getting that, then it's going to be a big problem. So I think that there's only one way he can go. He's not going to sit on the bench, and if he's not going to give Pep what he needs in his team, then he has to leave. He's going to leave for an astronomical amount of money. Gabriel Jesus has started really well. He has the potential to be one of the best players in the world. They're going to have to bring another striker in, but they're really starting to show signs of what they're capable of. Again, a bit like Liverpool, they need talent.
Yeah.
They need another centre-half. They need... probably a goalie. I don't know how that's going to work, but you know, like, I love goalkeepers that can pass the ball, but you still have to save shots. And Caballero looks like he might be better than Bravo.
I mean, he got dropped. Bravo got dropped for two games.
Yeah,
now, so.
And Caballero's been absolutely magnificent on the ball, and he looks like he has a bit more presence for me for the English game. So they're on the right track. They need fullbacks. Can he somehow get one of the guys for Bayern Munich? I don't know. Players don't normally leave Bayern Munich, but if he can get a Lahm or a Kimmich or an Alaba, then it's going to be a massive coup for them.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, if he can replace like Aguero, I mean, very unlikely with like a Sanchez, you're pretty much done.
Yeah.
Oh, like, sure. But I think the defensive problems. I mean, something I wanted to ask you actually is, we talked about Arsenal and the kind of collective failure to defend. And I'm wondering if City isn't a similar case. Okay, I think the fullbacks definitely need replacing. I think to play the style they want to play, it's mental that Gael Clichy and Sanya and Kolarov, et cetera, are still there.
Yeah.
But if they replace the centre-backs, is the style not the problem? I mean, I'm just wondering if they put another centre-back in there, is it going to make any difference?
Yeah, I think it is, and I'm going to explain why, because the style of football that he plays needs perfection or very close to it. And there's centre-halves out there that are perfect in that style. They've proved it for his teams in the past, and he's got to try and bring in a guy of that calibre. Now, John Stones has a lot of potential. He makes a lot of mistakes. We could probably argue between the three as will he become that guy or will he keep making mistakes? I don't know. We still don't really know that. But for me, he has enough potential to say he might become that guy. But he needs somebody next to him. And unfortunately for Pep, Vincent Kompany's been injured. He's not the player that he was. He probably never will be. But if we can, get somebody like a Vincent Kompany alongside him, then he can really develop. Whereas right now, the poor lad has to take all the burden on his own shoulders. He's trying to lead an Otamendi who's not capable of that level, or a Kolarov who's did very well at centre-half but still is not a title-winning centre-half.
I think it's very similar to when Piqué moved to Barcelona and he needed Puyol to kind of help him come through, and then Puyol left and Piqué now took the reins.
He
needs someone like that to help him a little bit, because right now he's supposedly their best centre-back.
But they still play someone like Mascherano next to him whenever they can.
Yeah.
There's
still
that difference in experience.
So I mean, City again slowly coming back into form.
I think they'll finish second. I think they're the second best team in the league.
I agree.
And I think they're showing that kind of form, and it's exciting to watch. It sounds, you know, like horrible to say, but it's exciting to watch Pep struggle a little bit and find solutions. How he's going to? It's fascinating. I don't know if it's exciting. That's the wrong word. Fascinating to see how he's going to find solutions while just never wavering for this
yeah.
style. You know, it's so stubborn, but so admirable the way he sticks to it.
I mean, in all his press comments / interviews, he's pretty much said, if you want me to change, sack me. Like, yeah. it's not going to happen. There's gonna no happen. Way. Yeah.
And City won't, because they spent three years trying to get him.
He's the right man.
You do not sack Pep Guardiola, ever. No matter what.
And that's something he'll always have over Mourinho. Another really good manager in the past two seasons, Pochettino.
He's been, for me, the best in the last couple of years.
He's adapted so well to the Premier League, yeah. moving from Southampton to Spurs. He's got them looking really good. I mean, last season they did, you know, come third in a two-horse race, which mm-hmm. is always funny
yeah.
for us, especially Arsenal fans. But he's done really well, and he's got them... I don't think he has the best, even fourth squad, maybe, in the league. But he has them playing as a second or third place team, and that's very admirable, I think.
Yeah, I love his style. I love the way that they play. Again, they're a team that's kind of transitioning to three at the back, where they're very capable of playing that. Where do you start? I love Lloris, magnificent goalkeeper. Probably behind Courtois and De Gea, but really good. Good with his feet and can make saves. Alderweireld, possibly the best centre half in the league.
Yeah,
like,
arguably,
really
yeah.
top. Got his injury. He's been, you know, a little bit average since then, but tremendous football player. And I like Eric Dier. I think Eric Dier's a player that could do very well for Man United. And I have sort of debates with people all the time about this because
at centre back.
Yeah, I think he's a great. I think he's a solid centre midfielder. I think he could be a really good centre back. Mm. And I think again. Modern football people love players that can play 3-4 positions.
Yeah.
He can play right back if need be. He can play right centre half. He can play centre half. He can play centre midfield. He's got a number of positions.
You
so,
think he should start over Vertonghen next to Alderweireld?
No, because I like Vertonghen and I think that Dyer's that option to go three at the back or he can sit in the midfield for them possibly. But I do think that he's a player that probably is and should be on Man United's radar for me. When Carrick signed for Man United, there was a lot of debate
yeah.
whether he was capable of that level, and then he went to that level, and I just got a feeling Dyer would be that guy as well.
Yeah. It's interesting about Vertonghen, I feel, and Alderweireld. I feel like Alderweireld has that Ledley King factor where anyone who plays next to him is
better.
Their level
yeah.
is brought
yeah,
up.
Right.
It was just like, I remember, I think, Vertonghen playing without him was something else completely, and I remember Michael Dawson
yeah.
and Ledley King together, fantastic. When King was out, Dawson just looked
yeah.
a shambles, and
yeah.
it was it's just one of those things, I think. But we're talking about Pochettino and the way he gets the team playing. He more than anyone else gets the team playing more than the sum of their parts, I
yeah.
feel. And to me, that's what makes the best managers. I don't know, is that
yeah, I agree. I think he's one of the best managers out there. His style is magnificent. He gets the best out of his players. They've got a good team. They've got a very good team. But I know what you're saying. It's just kind of, doesn't he have that size like a Man U? Or
yeah.
they don't have that star sort of guy. But I think it really suits them to have him as their coach. I think I love the way they play it for the back. Ali, obviously, is a fantastic player. Kane needs support. Janssen was one of his flops. You know, Wanyama was a magnificent signing. Janssen was a real flop. If they had that other striker, maybe who was a little bit different for Harry Kane, I
yeah.
think it would give them another dimension. So I think they'll be a wee bit short in that area. But again, the fullbacks have really grown under Pochettino. They're playing high up. They're playing their strengths. They're not really the best defenders, but they're not getting asked to defend because of the shape of the team.
So we've covered the top six. Let's quickly go through the last few games.
Yep.
I know time is running along here, but very quickly, Everton-Bournemouth was a fantastic 6-3.
Yeah.
Lukaku, that first goal was, I mean, top class. Like, that was Messi
class.
That was, I mean, people know my love for Messi, and no one even comes close, ever will be, blah, 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 all this stuff. But I saw that goal, and I was so impressed. Right foot, left
yeah.
foot, strength, agility for such a big guy. And that was extremely impressive. And you know, he always kind of, every summer, will he make
yeah.
the jump? Will he, you know, Man United, maybe the next kind of Zlatan for the
yeah.
top, or if Costa leaves in the summer, could Chelsea bring him back?
Yeah.
He has to make that jump soon.
Yeah, I think there's things missing from his game. When he's good, he's unbelievable.
Mm.
He's world class. But for me, it's the little simple things that he needs to improve on. Once I see that in his game, then I'll agree with you. Yes, he's ready. He can go to one of the top teams. But right now, I think sometimes he has the games that comes up to him, it bounces off him. He doesn't hold the ball up like Acosta or even as Zlatan. And Zlatan's a little bit different. He's not involved a lot in the play. But he needs to improve that side of his game. But when he's having a game like Saturday, he's just unplayable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Crystal Palace, Sunderland. This is weird. For the first time, as long as I can remember, Sam Allardyce hasn't had the Sam Allardyce effect. And I read this morning that he brought the players back in the next morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, to give them a rollicking or whatever it was. What's going on here? Well, I mean, it's very strange. I mean, Sam Allardyce has a formula, and it always works.
Also, Crystal Palace are a good team. It's not like Sunderland from last season. They're good enough to be kind of mid-table. Like, they're not horrendous.
Well, there's big problems there, obviously. I mean, when two guys, Pardew, who had a decent reputation, does a poor job, gets sacked, Sam comes in, everybody thinks, oh, Sam will sort them out. We'll see the reaction. No reaction. There's something rotten here. There's a real problem in this club. I'm sure Sam knows what it is. He probably can't really fix it this time. Can he band-aid it enough just to get through it and keep them up, and then change in the summer, go through the changes that are needed? I think it's really concerning for them. They're in the same kind of boat as Leicester for me. I think they'll just have enough again. They'll pick up a result or two when it really matters. But yeah, very concerning, and there's something not right about the football club, about some players or some kind of faction in the dressing room.
Right.
I'm not there, I'm not privy to be inside, but I'll guarantee there's something going on at that football club that needs sorted. Sam will know exactly what that is, but
time.
It's going to take time to get it fixed. Yeah.
Politeness wars. On the other side, Sunderland with the best game of all season almost. Jermaine Defoe's got 14 goals. At 34, it's exceptional. You played with him briefly in Toronto. How was that in training?
It was great. Jermaine's a fantastic player and a great guy. I'd played against him a number of times, but I never knew him personally, and he's a good friend of mine. I think it was disappointing what happened in Toronto. I don't know exactly why it happened, but I think he came here and he decided that it wasn't for him. He wanted to go back home, and it was dealt with. It probably should have been dealt with a little bit earlier, but it was dealt with and he went back home. So, you know, good luck to him. He's been magnificent. He's playing at one of my former clubs. He's scoring goals galore and one of the worst defensive teams.
Not a lot of service to him. Like, he's making it work. I mean, the best image before he moved on from this game was that, like, 3 or 4-0 up, David Moyes was clapping a goal, and he could kind of see, he couldn't believe what was going on. He was just like clapping. He was like a fan. Like, he was almost like, this is not my work. Like, this is something is happening.
It's a miracle.
Southampton lost to West Ham 3-1. I mean, really quickly, Payet leaving kind of almost galvanized them in some way. They've been really good since he's left.
Yeah.
Carroll's been back from injury, which does help. He scored almost goal this season, arguably, as well.
Yeah.
With that left kind of sidekick.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's almost ironic that Payet leaving kind of saved Bilic's job a little bit. Like, it almost like kind of created a team bond between everyone else. Like, well, he's the outsider, and we're all gonna kind of,
when you kick someone off your WhatsApp chat, like, it's, you know,
you're out.
Yeah. What else about the last two games here?
Yeah, Watford, Burnley. Jeff Hendrick's tackle was a bit mental. So early in the game, he didn't seem to think it would. Have you ever been in that situation where you make a tackle, you think it's fine, and you watch it back and it was horrendous?
I actually made one near the end of my career in Toronto. We were in Salt Lake City and we were getting a real pasting, and it was one of the ones where you have to make a statement. Now, obviously, I would try to win the ball, but I tried to be very forceful with my tackle, and I think it was Grabovoy. He got there first, and it was a poor tackle. I got a yellow card, and then I got a retrospective ban. But it happens, and sometimes it's, you know, Jeff Hendrick's not a malicious player. I'm sure he didn't go in to hurt anybody, but it happens. You go in, you look back, and you're like, oh, that was horrible, and it was kind of one of them.
I think he was playing for Man United. There would have been a yellow. Would have been fine.
That may be
a warning.
Yeah. West Brom beat Stoke 1-0. I mean, West Brom. I think the formula there was kind of rumors that there was going to be Chinese ownership and Pulis was going to leave.
Yeah.
That seemed to be the formula for them. And then from then on, it just kicked off. And Pulis almost started playing better football.
Well, he got some players in that helped him do that. But yeah.
I mean, not really much to say about West Brom or Stoke. Kind of like...
just two solid mid-table teams, you know. Like, I really think the mid-table in Premier League's improved. Obviously, money helps that. They can go out and sign guys between 10 and 25 million these days, you know, which never really happened in the past. So they two teams are solid for me. They'll always be in that 8th to 15th position. Yeah. You know, they'll never get relegated, but they'll probably never get up into the top six.
Okay, well, let's end it with some predictions, put you on the spot.
Yeah, I mean, let's look at the bottom six for now, because it's as tight as I can remember the relegation battle being. I mean, you've got Sunderland bottom on 19 points, and then Middlesbrough 15th on 21. It's all a win away. So, what do you reckon?
Yeah, it's a hard one, because I always let my heart roll my head. I think Sunderland are going to go down. I hope I'm wrong. Really, probably the only team I really want to stay up. I have an invested interest in.
I mean, Burnley aren't that far.
No, I was going to say that, actually. I was going to say I would not be surprised if one of Burnley, Southampton or Bournemouth get dragged in. I've got a feeling that might be Southampton. I just see someone there that they're going to... I know they have quality, but...
Let me give you a stat that might change your mind. Yep. Bournemouth, winless in 2017, one victory in eight, conceded 34 in the last 13.
I mean, they lost their two centre-backs. Ake went back to Chelsea and injuries, and now also I can't remember his name, but he got an ACL injury.
Yeah.
The striker. So,
Wilson.
Yeah, they're not looking very solid at this moment.
They're conceding a lot of goals, and that's a concern, and they're starting to get in that free-fall type position. It's not looking good for them. I wouldn't be surprised for them, but I think Eddie Howe's a fantastic coach, and he really prepares them properly for every game. So again, I've got a feeling they'll pick up. I mean, at this point, it's like two or three wins to probably drag you away, because you can't expect the other six to keep winning games, you know. So they've probably got enough. It's probably between the six. Sunderland, Palace, I'm really worried about. I think maybe it'll stay the way it is. Possibly Palace changing places with Swansea.
Ooh, interesting. I think Clement's got them doing better, but the question is, is it enough?
You never know. Top of the table, top four, Chelsea winning the league.
Chelsea comfortably. Okay. They're the best team by a mile. I think City, Spurs, and then that last place is really up for debate. I've got a feeling that Man United might get in it. I think that Arsenal are falling a little, and Liverpool look exhausted.
Yeah, I mean, Arsenal are coming up to that February curse anyways. They're going to play well one game against Bayern, get better the second,
But this is what happens with Arsenal. We start to think, oh, you know, they're going to miss out, and then we stop caring about the results, and they go win some games, and they make top four.
That's the
thing,
once there's nothing left to play for beyond that, they start to put a run together. But yeah, anyway. All right, thank you very much. We'll leave it there. It's been an absolute pleasure, and hopefully we'll be able to talk to you again.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Alright guys, I hope you enjoyed that as much as we did. It was fantastic talking to Stephen. He's now gone, but we can't leave you without Moomoo of the Week. It's our favourite segment, and without further ado, here we go.
Happy Moomoo. One thing we are no sha, Moomoo not fit sleep forever. One day Moomoo go wake up.
It's Moomoo time, and since Bernie, our number one resident African, isn't here, I get to take over. I mean, Egypt is technically in Africa, but for some reason I'm written off every week.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's just people not knowing geography. Don't worry about it.
True. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we're Arab as well, so like we flip-flop. So, for those who don't know, Moomoo in Pidgin English means a fool, an idiot. And we'd like to kind of highlight those people in football on a weekly basis for their actions off the field of play. I'll give you an example. Here's mine for this week. So, Brian Oviedo signed from Everton to Sunderland.
I mean, Mumu move number one.
Already.
Yeah.
Fine. Granted, he did win 4-0 on his debut. But, you know. So what he did was, you know, he does this thing where a player kind of puts up a new picture of himself in his new club's kit. But because he hasn't actually done the photo shoot, they just kind of Photoshop his head on a body.
Great.
So what he ended up doing is, which he had to take down, by the way, is he ended up putting his head on Adam Johnson's body. And people were obviously just having a great laugh about it. I mean, if you're going to pick an ex-Sunderland player to put your face on, don't pick the paedophile.
Wait, are we assuming he picked him?
Yeah, he did, because it was on his own Twitter. He picked it. Yeah.
You don't reckon like the club helped him out?
I mean, what? This is a free spot? Just take it.
We've got this image. We don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, and it is an image, to be fair. Yeah, so, I mean, he's going to have to live, I guess, up or down to that.
So how do we know? Like, how was he identified?
Because everybody told him these are his, you know, Adam Johnson's boots and his shirt number and all that. And they told him to take it off. So he did.
Good for him.
Good start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Mine is another Premier League legend, Mark Hughes, who, you know, everyone knows I hate him.
Yeah.
And this is part of the reason. So Mark Hughes, traditional man, he's really big on handshakes. Really loves a handshake, and he gets really pissed off when people don't give them to him. So here's Mark. Okay, he had a new one this week at the end of the game between West Brom and Stoke.
Right,
Pulis didn't shake his hand. Now Pulis says it was because Mark Hughes walked away and wasn't there.
I can believe it.
Mark Hughes says, and I quote: "I didn't see Pulis to shake his hand. I was on the touchline for some time after the game. Who's the onus on? I don't know. He didn't shake my hand before the game either. I would have thought, being the guest of the club, he would have come over and welcomed me to the ground."
Red carpet, a basket of fruit.
Champagne.
Yeah.
That's this week. Right. Yeah. Earlier this season, Stoke City manager Mark Hughes says Walter Mazzarri has apologised for refusing to shake hands after his side's 1-0 victory at Watford, but he feels he may have been told to do so. Speaking to Sky Sports, Hughes said, "I think he just forgot for a brief moment what we do over here."
Oh, come on.
Win, lose, or draw, you should always offer your hand. In fairness, he came and apologised, but I think he was told to. He's so bitter.
I mean, I was almost okay with some parts of that until he said, "over here." Like, it's just so xenophobic. Like,
it gets better. Yeah, okay. It gets better. 2011, Roberto Mancini.
Wow, you dug deep.
Oh, mate. "It's probably my fault again," Hughes said sarcastically, "but I'm a little old-fashioned. I always think if you offer your hand, it should be accepted regardless of the circumstances. Maybe I misread it, but I just didn't think Roberto acknowledged the efforts of my team and how well we'd done by the way he offered his hand."
He offered it in Italian, maybe.
Yeah. So it's not just enough to offer the handshake. You have to do it in such a way that Mark Hughes feels you're being...
So defensively.
Yes. Yeah. And I wish it stopped there, Mo. I really do.
Right.
Two more incidents with Pulis in 2010.
Okay.
So those two are having a ball. And three other handshake-related incidents. Two in 2009, one with Yol, one with Wenger. Sorry, three more, and one with Allardyce.
So he has a history.
A massive history.
I mean...
He cares about this more than anything.
Yeah, you put that in front of a jury and he doesn't look very good.
No.
Yeah.
He needs to shake it off.
I mean, if I knew this about him and I was the opposition manager, I would almost just not wanna. after the list. All right, well, I mean, those are two very good definitions of Mumu right there.
Absolutely.
Happy Mumu. One thing we all know, sha, Mumu no fit live forever. One day, Mumu go wake up.
Thank you for downloading the Koshcast. Get in touch at underthekoshblog@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at under_thekosh. And for articles, predictions, and the full experience, go to underthekoshblog.com.